So I've been trying for a little while to read Richard Bausch's story to you since it was requested of one of you a couple of months ago, and because I never like to disappoint. But the thing is, I've had a Richard Bausch story in mind, and it's too funny, and I haven't been able to read it without laughing, and it's among the funniest I know anyway, so I thought that maybe I should save it for when I really needed to dig myself out of some trouble or controversy. Illicit business deals or photographs that should remain hidden, that sort of thing. But it hasn't happened yet, and the story's just too good to keep it in my back pocket for any longer. That would be a little bit malevolent. So, I'm going to trust you to keep your knowledge of my shadiness to yourself for just a little while longer until I dig up a nice replacement. And so, good evening. It's Monday, the 9th of April, 2007, and it's Miette's Bedtime Story Podcast. Nobody in Hollywood by Richard Bausch. I was pummeled as a teenager. For some reason, I had the sort of face that asked to be punched. It seemed to me, in those days, that everybody wanted to take a turn. Something about the curve of my mouth, I guess. It made me look like I was being cute with people, smirking at them. I am what is called a late life child. My brother Doak is 20 years older and played semi-pro football. But by the time I came along, Doak was through as a ball player, and my father had given up on ever seeing a son play pro. I was a month premature and very, very tiny as a child. Dad named me Ignatius after an uncle of his that I never knew. Of course, I didn't take to sports, though I could run pretty fast. That comes with having a face people want to hit. I liked to read. I was the family bookworm. I'm 4'9" tall. Doak married young, divorced young, and had a son, Doak Jr., that the wife took with her to Montana. But Doak missed the boy, and went out there to be near him, and when I graduated from high school, he invited me for a visit. That's how I ended up in Montana in 1971. I'd gone to spend the summer with Doak in a hunter's cabin up in the mountains. It was a little cottage with a big stone hearth and knotty pine panelling and colour photos of the surrounding country. On the shelf above the hearth were some basketball trophies belonging to the guy who owned the place, a former college all-star now working as an ophthalmologist down in Dutton. Doak taught me how to fly fish. A fly rod had a lot of importance to Doak, as if being good with a thing was a key to the meaning of life or something. He had an image of himself, standing in sunlight, fly rod in hand. He was mystical about the enterprise, though he really didn't have much ability. While I was staying with Doak, I met Hildy, my eventual ex-wife. She was a nurse in the hospital, where Doak took me the night I met his new girlfriend, Samantha. I met Samantha about 2 hours before I met Hildy. Samantha had come home to Montana from San Francisco, where she'd been with her crazy mother. Before I met her, many days before, Doak had talked about how beautiful and sexy she was. According to Doak, I just wasn't going to believe my eyes. He'd met her in a bar he used to frequent after working construction all day in Dutton. She was only 25. He told me all about her, day after day. We were drinking pretty heavy in the evenings, and he'd tell me about what she had gone through in her life. "She's so beautiful to have gone through that stuff," he said. "Suicide and insanity and abuse, a lot of abuse. She's part Indian. She's had hard times. Her father was a full-blooded Cherokee. She's a genius. He killed himself. Then her mother went crazy and they put her in this institution for the insane over in San Francisco. Her mother didn't know her own name anymore. Oh, Samantha's pathetic, really. Think about it, and she looks like a goddess." I can't even find the words for it. Beautiful. Nobody in the world, not even Hollywood. At the time, I was worried about getting drafted into the army and was under a lot of stress. They were drafting everybody back then, and I was worried. I didn't want to hear about Doak's beautiful girlfriend. "Man," he said, "I wish I had a picture, a snapshot of her, so I could show you. But the Indian blood means she has this thing about having a picture taken, like it steals part of her soul. They all believe that." He was talking about her the night she arrived, the travelling she'd done when she was a back dancer for the Rolling Stones. "She knows Mick Jagger, man." And the heavy things she'd done, abused children and illicit drugs and alcohol, and the positions she liked during sex, and the various ways they had of doing it together. "She's an Indian," he said. "They have all kinds of weird ways." "Could we go out onto the porch or something?" I said. He hadn't heard me. "She wears a headband. It expresses her people. When she was 6, her mother went crazy the first time. A white woman, the mother, right? This poor girl from Connecticut with no idea what she was getting into, marrying this guy, coming out here to live almost like a pioneer. Only the guy turned out to be a wild man. They lived on the reservation, and nobody else wanted anything to do with him because of how he was. A true primitive, but a noble one, too. You should hear Samantha talk about him. He used to take her everywhere. And he had this crazy thing about rock concerts. Like they were from the old days of the tribe, see? He'd go and dance and get really drunk. Samantha went with him until she was in her teens. She actually has a daughter from when they were travelling with the Rolling Stones. The daughter's staying with her mother's sister back east. It's a hell of a story. She's only 25. He nodded. Had a daughter when she was 17. The Rolling Stones, I said. Something. Don't give me that look, he said. I smiled as big as I could. No, I said. Really, I wasn't. I'd just like to go outside. It's kind of stuffy in here, isn't it? Could be Mick Jagger's kid, my brother said significantly. Samantha knew him. Well, I said. Hey, she'll be here soon. We better clean up a little. He poured himself another drink. What have we done in our lives? He said, staring at the table and looking sad. I've worked a few jobs, bought a car here and there, got married and got divorced. And you graduated from high school, went to the prom, right? I mean, we haven't really experienced anything. Imagine having your father kill himself. How did he do it? I asked. I told you, he said. He shot himself. Jesus, are you listening to me? A little while later, Samantha pulled in, and we went out to greet her. She'd been driving for 2 days, she told us. It was almost full dark, but from what I could see, she looked like death itself. We all went inside, and Doak poured more whiskey. He kept watching me, waiting for some signs, I suppose. I couldn't give him one. He'd built up so many of my expectations that I'd begun to think beyond what was really possible for a big, not-too-nice-looking former high school football star with a pot belly and a double chin. Samantha wasn't pretty. Not by a very, very, very long stretch. And it wasn't just the fact that she'd been sitting behind the wheel of a ratty, carbon monoxide-spewing car for 2 days. She could have just walked out of a beauty parlour after an all-afternoon session and it wouldn't have made any difference. She did have nice dark skin, but her eyes were set deep in her skull and they were crossed a little. They were also extremely small, the smallest eyes I ever saw, like a rodent's eyes, black and with a scary glitter in them. They fixed on you as if you were something to eat and swallow. She was tall and had long legs, and she had hips wider than Doak's. Her hair was shiny, crow-black, and stiff. She let it grow wild, so it appeared she hadn't seen a brush in her lifetime. She was not physically beautiful by any standard you care to name. Doak stood by, staring, all moony-eyed and weepy with the booze and love, and I guess I couldn't keep the surprise out of my face. I had thought I was going to meet this beautiful woman. Instead, I met Samantha. "I have to go freshen up," she said, after we'd been through the introductions. She went into the bathroom and closed the door with a delicate little click of the latch. Then we heard what sounded like water being poured out of a big vat into other water. Doak turned to me. "Well," he said, "right?" "Jesus Christ," I said. I thought he meant the sound. "Isn't she beautiful?" I said, "right." "You ever see anything?" he said. He was standing by the table, tottering a little, holding on to the back of the chair. "You know?" I said, "yeah." He just pulled the chair out and sat down and ran his hands through his hair. "Just," he said. "Really?" I nodded. "Right?" he said. I said, "uh-huh." He picked up the bottle and drank. Then he shook his head. "Something." "Wow," I said. After another drink and a few seconds of staring off, he said, "What's the matter with you?" He still wasn't looking at me. I said, "Nothing. Why?" He poured more whiskey, then sat there and seemed to study it. "You got something to say?" "Can't think of anything," I said. He looked at me and I sat down too. "Well," he said, "I don't like that look." "She's been on the road," I said. "She's tired." "Not her. You. I don't like your look." I ran my hands over my face. I thought he might think I was smirking at him. "Oh," I said, "I'm okay." "That isn't what I mean," he said. I reached for the whiskey. "I think I'll have some more of that," I told him. "That all right with you?" He didn't answer. He was thinking. Samantha came out of the bathroom. I didn't know what she'd done to freshen up. Nothing had changed at all. She sat down and leaned back in the chair and clasped her hands behind her head. "So, this is your brother?" "That's him," Doak said. "You're so little compared to Doak. It's so strange." She went over and got herself a glass, brought it back to the table where Doak poured her some of the whiskey. "I told Ignatius about your dad and mum," he said. She drank, then shook her head. "Terrible." She looked a lot older than 25. She had little gold rings piercing her ears, the rings that went all the way up the side of her each ear. This was the first time I ever saw that phenomenon. "I got a baby that's severely retarded. The oxygen wasn't right." Duke seemed surprised. "You never said she was retarded." "That's what I said," she nodded sadly. She was watching me. "My father took me to Altamont. I was there. I know Mick Jagger." "It might be his kid," Duke said, all excited. "Right?" She seemed to think this over. "No, I doubt it." "But it could be, though, right?" She frowned. "No." "Didn't you?" Duke said, then stopped. He was confused. "We saw them. We were close, you know, but not that close." Nobody said anything. I was watching Doak because I couldn't look at Samantha. The difference between his description of her and the reality was too much. He said, "Well, I thought you said the kid was Jagger's kid." "Suppose it could be. I've had so many lovers back then." "You mean you might not have noticed it was Mick Jagger," I said. She looked at me. "Why do you look at me like that?" she said. Dirk took a drink. He was thinking. I said something to smooth things over. I have the kind of face that makes people think I'm being smart with them.
"He's always got that look," Dirk said.
"Where's your kid?" I asked her. She said, "With my mother's family back east. My father was killed by the government for protesting against them." "I thought your father killed himself," Dirk said. "He did." We waited for her to clear up the mystery. "The government drove him to it?" "Hell," I said. She nodded importantly. "The government is not legitimate, you know, as long as there are whites living on Indian lands."
"Which Indian lands?" I said.
"The whole country."
"Oh, you mean, like the Constitution and all that? That's not valid."
"Right," she said. "Not much chance of that going away," I said, meaning to sympathize with her. "My father was a full-blooded Cherokee," she said. "Dirk told you, I'm sure."
"I told him," Dirk said. "I told him about that, and I told him about the Rolling Stones."
"It wasn't just the Rolling Stones. I travelled a lot. I had 300 lovers before I was 22.
Dirk shook his head.
"Looking for love," I said. She said, "At least 300 of them."
"Lovers," I said. She nodded.
"What was it that interested you about them, if you don't mind my asking?"
Her little eyes were on me, and her face twisted as if she smelled something bad.
"What? Are you making fun?" Dirk asked me. His face was a total blank.
"No," I said. I was truly curious. With that many lovers, it was hard to imagine that there wouldn't be some sort of filing system to keep track of the types, anyway. Dirk was staring at me, so I put my hand over my mouth, which I had come to think of as the offending part of my face. He shook his head again, then poured some more whiskey. I sat back and pretended to be relaxed and interested while Samantha talked about herself and her adventures. She was related to Crazy Horse, she said, and on her mother's side there was a distant connection to Mary Lincoln. She had lived in Haight-Ashbury and attended the University of California at Berkeley, majoring in law. She had plans to enter the system and ruin it from the inside. The collapse of the American government was the only hope for her and her people, but her father had this thing about rock concerts, and she'd got sidetracked. For years she'd followed the Grateful Dead around from concert to concert. She knew Jerry Garcia well. She'd had a child by him that died, and it was why she left to seek out the Rolling Stones. She liked their names better. Once, when she was only 13, she'd met John F. Kennedy. Dirk sipped the whiskey, watching me. I was beginning to get sleepy. She droned on. She'd been a member of the Weathermen, and the FBI had crushed them with bombs and fire and infiltrators. Dirk was staring at me, waiting for the first sign that I wasn't utterly charmed, but I was actively fighting sleep. He had a big stake in her, and I didn't want to hurt his feelings. Samantha had fixed me with her rodent's eyes, but my eyes were so heavy I rubbed them, put my hands over a yawn. "I'm very sensitive to spiritual vibrations," she said. "It's my Indian blood." This was in reference to something I must have missed in the long monologue, because Dirk said, "So that's how you knew he was going to kill himself?" "Yes," she said, "but there wasn't anything I could do. It was his karma." She went on to talk about karma and how a person's karma caused a glow she could perceive. "I'm very perceptive," she said. "I can sense what a person is thinking. I get vibes from people." I was thinking, please stop talking. "It's really kind of uncanny," she went on. "I look in a person's eyes and I see all their thoughts, their innermost feelings." "Shut the fuck up, please," I was thinking. "Go to bed." She never seemed to take a breath. She said, "I learned this when I met Robert Kennedy at his house in McLean, Virginia. I was 18, and I think he was interested in me physically, too. It was so odd how he met me. I just walked up and knocked on his door, and his maid, Eva was her name. Well, I sure am beat," I said. I was desperate now. "Guess I'll turn in." "I was telling you something," she said. I said, "You must be awfully tired." "I was in the middle of telling you something, and you just started talking about turning in." She seemed to pout. I caught myself actually feeling sorry for her. "We've been keeping you up," I said. "You must be exhausted." I stood, vaguely intending to make polite conversation as I left the room. "She was telling you something," Dirk said. "Do you have an Indian name?" I asked Samantha. She shook her head. "My mother insisted that I be given a white woman's name. She knew I would have a terrible time growing up in the white man's world." I didn't say anything. She added, "It would have split me in two, and you know how terrible it is to be split down the middle." She reached over and played with the crown of Dirk's hair. I said I supposed I didn't. I yawned. She said, "It's much worse than you can imagine, and I'm sorry it bores you." She seemed proud to have plumbed my feelings. "I'm fine," I said, "just tired." And then there didn't seem to be anything else to talk about. She sat there. She was biting her nails, taking in the room with those little eyes. I had come to the realization that she was no more of Indian blood than I was the King of Spain. I had an image of her parents, a couple of Italians probably, holding down an apartment in Brooklyn, wondering where their daughter ran off to. I said, "What's Mick Jagger like?" "Very grungy and nervous." She was biting her nails still. I said, "Everything you've told us is a crock, right?" "You can disbelieve me if you want," she said. "I don't care." I looked at Dirk. "Man," I said. Then I started out of the room. Bedtime. But Dirk stood suddenly, and when I turned, he took me by the front of my shirt. "You think you can treat us like this?" I said, "Okay, look, I'm sorry. I didn't mean anything." "Leave him be," Samantha said. "It's his loss." "Will you excuse us for a few seconds?" Dirk said to her. She got up and went outside. "We could join her," she said, "when we were through being babies." She closed the door, and Dirk walked me back against the wall, still holding my shirt in his fists. "I saw the way you were looking at her." "What difference does it make what I think?" I said. "A mistake." "Oh," he said, "what do you think?" "Cut it out," I said. "Come on, let me go." "Not till you tell me what you think of Samantha." "I think she's a liar," I told him. "And she's not even a very good one." I couldn't help myself. "And on top of that, I think she's ugly as month-old pizza." He commenced hitting me. He was swinging wildly, and some of his punches missed, which allowed me to get under the table. Then he started kicking. I was crawling around, trying to get away from him, and Samantha had come back in to stop him. When he stormed out into the dark, she got down on the floor and saw that I was bleeding from a gash in my forehead. I must have hit the edge of the table on my way under it, and she was really quite gentle and sweet, getting a rag for my head and insisting that Dirk would take me down to Dutton to the emergency room. As I said, it was while I was in the hospital that I met Hildy. "That's a nasty cut," was the first thing she said to me. "Yes, ma'am," I said. I thought she was perfect. I wouldn't expect anyone else to think so, necessarily. "How did it happen?" she asked. "My brother and I got in a fight." She shook her head, concentrating on her work, cutting a bandage to size for me. "Two grown boys like you." "I could tell you about it," I said. That was all it needed. My mother used to say, when the time is right, you don't need to have a committee meeting about it. When I eventually returned to the cabin, I found that Samantha had gone. She'd picked up and headed off into the West, with a few of Doak's records and tapes and most of the money he'd saved. He took it pretty hard. For a while that summer, he had himself convinced that because she'd taken those things, she was planning on coming back. But the months turned into the rest of the year, and I stayed on through the next spring and part of the summer, and she was just gone. His drinking got pretty bad, and I started having to look out for the boy a lot on the weekends. "It's not fair, I know it," Dirk said to me. "I can't shake it, though." "You've got to get a hold of yourself," I told him. I'd been seeing Hildy. We were married at the end of that next summer, and for a while Dirk's boy lived with us while Dirk dried out in rehab. The boy's mother was in some sort of rehab herself. Drugs. Sometimes back then it seemed to me that the whole country had gone crazy. Hildy and I were together for almost 20 years. We never had any children. Doak left Montana and lives in Seattle now. He's happy. Some stories do have happy endings, for a while anyway. He'd got a wife and another boy and a girl. He probably never thinks about Samantha. I used to imagine the Italian couple in Brooklyn reunited with their wayward little girl who had pulled up one day, driving a car full of music and money. She was such a bad liar. Duke's son married a nice girl from Catalina, then moved to New York. Everybody got along fine, really. Hildy and I lived for a few years in a little three-bedroom rambler on Coronado Street in Sandusky, Illinois. Those first years we had a lot of fun, usually. Now and then she'd lose her temper, and my old trouble would return. Something about my face would cause her to start swinging at me. And I never hit back, but it doesn't, as the saying goes, take two to make a fight. One person with an urge to hit somebody else is enough. For the person getting knocked out, it might as well be the heavyweight championship. One night, when we were drinking, I told her about Samantha. I must have been a little careless in how I talked about Samantha's physical qualities, because I upset Hildy. These days you say something about one woman, and you've said it about all of them. "Is that the way you see us?" she says. "Us?" I said. "What?" "Is that how you judge women? You see that I'm gaining weight, don't you? And you see me just like this Samantha person." I said, "I'm just saying she wasn't what Dirk said she was." "It just kills me that that's how you think." For about a year, things had been going sour. Hildy had ballooned to about 250 pounds. I had lost weight. And I was worried all the time about money. So was she, but her worry came out differently. She kept asking me what I thought of her. "You think I'm ugly now," she'd say, "right? That's how you see me? Why don't you come out and say it?" "I think you're fine," I'd say. Tell me the truth, I'm too big.
No, I'd say, really, hon.
You're lying, I can see it in your face.
My face, again, there was nothing I could say. And besides, I was about half her size by now.
Once I said, do you think you're too big?
It's not important what I think, she said,
because God damn it, I know how you think, all of you.
We needed extra income, and she hated the idea of nursing anymore, so she got a job serving food at a hospital cafeteria across the river in Missouri. There were nights when we didn't say anything to each other, and after a few months she started doing things to get shut of me. That was okay. I think I even understood. She made dates with a janitor on her floor, a man 15 years older than I am and a lot bigger. She told people she was leaving me. She had friends over at all hours, day and night. When I walked in and someone asked who I was, she'd wave me away. That's my soon-to-be ex, she'd say. It was always said like a joke, but you could feel the edge to it. I never answered. I went about my business and tried not to get mad. She was as big as a Buick. She weighed more than my whole family put together, including Dirk. I never mentioned that the bed sagged on her side and that I was having to replace the mattress every 6 months. I'd watch her settle into a seat in a steak joint, order a porterhouse the size of an infant, and I wouldn't say a word. I said nothing about her jeans, which were big enough to throw over a rhinoceros and keep it dry in the rain. The night she kicked me out, she came home with a new friend. A new lover, she told me. She made her lover wait out on the front lawn while she broke the news. "Do you understand me, Ignatius? I want you out. I've decided I don't need a man to tell me who I am. You can stay until you find a place, sleep on the sofa, but Grace is moving in with us." Grace had walked into the hospital cafeteria several weeks before after having been bandaged up in the emergency room. She'd been in a traffic accident, and her nose and upper lip were cut. Hildy and she got to talking, and pretty soon they were meeting for drinks after Hildy's shifts. It was just like Hildy and me, in a way, except now she was deciding that she wanted a woman and not a man. I never thought much of myself, but this hurt me. "She's the most interesting person I've ever been around," Hildy said, "and you and I haven't been anything to each other for a long time." This was true. Grace walked up to the door, and Hildy opened it and stepped back for her to come in, acting like this was the grand entrance of her happiness. Grace had a big white bandage over her nose, but we weren't in the same room more than 15 minutes before I recognized Samantha. Blonder this time, a few pounds heavier, a little fuller in the face, but unmistakably her. "Hello, Grace." She looked at me with those little black eyes and then sat on the couch next to Hildy. I went into the bedroom and started packing, throwing shirts in a suitcase and some slacks and socks and underwear. I wasn't sure what I should take with me. I could hear Samantha/Grace in the next room. She had built her own house, she was saying. She had learned to play several musical instruments, but then forgot how. She had spent the night with Sting during a thunderstorm and power outage in Atlanta. By the time I got back to the living room, she was talking about Mount St. Helens. She was there when it blew. She almost died. "Ever been on the reservation?" I asked. I was putting a few of my books in my suitcase. They both looked at me, as though I had trees growing out of my head. "Reservation?" Samantha/Grace asked. I couldn't tell if she recognized me. She stared. Then she smiled. So I smiled back, and then resumed packing.
She said, "I've done so much wandering around. I've been in almost every state of the Union, and made love in each one of them, too." "I always wanted to go to Hawaii," Hildy said, laughing. "Oh, absolutely. I've been there. I was married and lived there, but I got divorced." "Must have been a tough week," I put in. It was a nasty thing to say, and it was the wrong time to say it. It made me look bad. I said, "Little joke, girls." "Oh," Samantha/Grace said. "Ha." Hilda shook her head. "Men." "Ha, ha," Samantha/Grace said. "Ever been to Montana?" I asked her. "I worked in the emergency ward at the hospital in Dutton," Hildy said. "A terrible, lonely job. That's where I had the misfortune of meeting Ignatius." And Samantha/Grace smiled and leaned back in her chair. "My name is not one that a person forgets easily. And you remember somebody as small as I am, too." She stared at me with those little wolverine's eyes and kept smiling. Clasping her hands behind her blonde head, Samantha/Grace said, "Well, you know, I guess to be truthful, I'd have to say I was never actually in Montana. That's one of the places I've never been." I couldn't help it. A laugh came up out of me like a sneeze. I laughed and laughed and went on laughing so hard that Hildy got mad, and the madder she got, the more I laughed. Before I had stopped laughing, she'd thrown all my things out onto the lawn. This was the last night of my marriage. I knew that, and that was all right by me. I wouldn't want anyone to think that I was complaining.